Chapter 20. Campion was quiet that night. I was sad about what had happened to Cyphel, angry and perplexed in equal measure, but there was still a component to his grief that I felt I could not quite share. I knew he had always liked her. I had caught those sidelong glances of his often enough to be aware when he had his eye on her, rather than me. Cyphel knew exactly how he felt about her as well. It was there in her expression whenever they spoke, that beguiling combination of amusement and haughtiness that she carried off so well. It was a look that expressed disdain at Campion's guarded advances, but also a kind of measured probationary respect as well. It was a look that said, "You dare to think that I will find you as interesting as you obviously find me? Well, perhaps in that very act of daring, you become interesting to me, if only fleetingly." Not that his advances were anything more than the flirtatious overtures of a game he had no intention of seeing to its conclusion. He liked her a lot, was intrigued by her, but I do not think it ever occurred to him to consummate that fascination by sleeping with her, or even prolonging one of the polite kisses shared between chatterlings. I should still have been jealous, no matter how innocent his intentions, but I could never bring myself to dislike Cyphel. That was the worst part of it. I was glad now, not that she was dead, but that I had never hated her, never given her short shrift, and I badly wanted to find the person who had murdered her, and I badly wanted to do unspeakable things to them. Come the morning, I found the robots waiting for me before breakfast. "We heard the dreadful news," Cadence said. "It is most unfortunate," Cascade said, "after all that you have suffered, to lose another of your line. Words cannot begin to express the depth of our sympathy." "Thank you," I said. "We understand there is going to be a ceremony of some kind," said Cadence. "Cyphel's funeral service. Most likely they'll schedule it for tomorrow or the day after. Once they've got what they can out of her mind, there'll be no sense in delaying it." "Will this service be a private matter for the line?" asked Cascade. "Ordinarily, yes. But I'm not sure that'll be the case now. Our guests are involved in this, too. We're all victims of the ambush, and we all knew Cyphel, you included. I'd imagine the ceremony will be open to all comers, Emirians as well. It'll be unusual, you know. Normally there isn't a body. When we die, it's usually far from home, thousands of years from another shatterling. They'll log us as missing at the next reunion, and if we don't show up at the one after that, then we'll be presumed dead. There'll be a ceremony, and then one of us will be tasked with creating the memorial. But because the death will have happened at least a circuit ago, it feels more as if we're commemorating some historic incident. It'll be different with Cyphel. It's going to feel a lot more personal, a lot more immediate." "If there is anything we can do to assist matters, please do not hesitate to ask," Cadence said. "I'll let Bettany know. I'm sure he'll already have been putting the arrangements in place." If the robots heard the tartness in my voice, my resentment at Bettany making all the key decisions, they had the decorum not to show it. "In view of developments, it would probably be better if we delayed our departure," Cascade said. "We are still anxious to be on our way, but we would also like to give our respects to Cyphel if the line allows it." "I'm sure it will. It's good of you to be flexible." "We have seen the respect you have accorded Hesperus," Cadence said. "The least we can do is reciprocate." I thanked the robots for their kindness. Breakfast was an ordeal. There were a million things we all wanted to say, but none of us was prepared to break the silence. Even Bettany kept his own counsel, saying nothing until the very end. At the back of all our thoughts was the suspicion that Cyphel's murderer could easily be sitting at the table, looking as downcast as the rest of us. "Cyphel's funeral will take place tomorrow," Bettany said, and for a moment we thought that was the end of his announcement. Then he scratched at his chin and added, "Today Mazerion will resume her questioning of the two prisoners. Events having forced a certain urgency upon us, I have given her permission to bring them both out of stasis." "We could lose them both," Campion said.
"We'll take that risk, but I don't think it's likely. The condition of Dulce's cabinet is rather better than that of the Jatina. I think we have an excellent chance of getting at least one of them out intact." His brow knitted. Bettany looked Campion hard in the eye. Unless you've changed your mind, it might be better if you kept away from the interrogation. Wiping her fingers with a napkin, Mazarian said, Campion can sit in if he wishes, just as long as he doesn't try to stop me this time. You do what you want, Campion said. I can think of a million things I'd rather be doing than watching you bully and torture the prisoners. Since they won't reveal the information voluntarily, I don't really see what choice I have. Mazarian folded her napkin and placed it back on the breakfast table. It's moot, anyway. As Bettany said, we're done with that phase of the inquiry. I'll have flesh and blood bodies by the end of the morning. At least one, anyway. Or none, if your luck doesn't hold out. She stared him down, managing not to blink once. The sectioning apparatus is ready. You are more than welcome to observe the procedure. We'll all be there, Bettany said. No excuses this time, unless you're on patrol duty. Purslane, that includes you. Next you'll be telling me I can't look away, I said. I want everyone to be present. We'll be studying your reactions, seeing who doesn't look comfortable. That'll be me, Campion said. I don't think there's any time for flippancy, Bettany cautioned. Campion shrugged and stood from the table, knowing when he had said enough. I followed him to the railing, out of earshot of the others. We had barely spoken this morning. When I woke at dawn, I had found him already out of bed, sitting on a chair on the balcony, looking out towards the dark silver dunes, with eyes reddened by tears that he had tried to rub away. We'll get through this, I said to him now. He took my hand and squeezed the fingers. I know. It's what I keep telling myself, but I don't feel it. If you told me Gentian Line would end tomorrow, I'd find that easier to believe. This is when we have to be the strongest, darkest hour before dawn, etc. Campion looked away. I could do without the platitudes. You know, there's a saying like that in almost every human culture that's ever existed. There's a reason for that, too. Sometimes you just have to hold on. Keep doing what you're doing, to have faith that things are going to get better. It's how we survive. There have been a million bottlenecks in history where things would have turned out much worse if we'd all just given up and accepted the inevitable. Some of those bottlenecks would have ended us if a few irrational, doggedly optimistic souls hadn't clung to a thread of hope. I'm clinging, believe me, but that thread just got a lot thinner, a lot more frayed. Then hold on more tightly. Something good will happen. I'm sorry Seifel died, but at least it tells us we're getting warm. Someone was scared enough to kill her. That means she was close to revealing vital information. Vital information that has now been lost forever. Someone else can take over her work. Seifel was the automatic choice for reconstructing your thread, but it doesn't mean someone else can't do it eventually. It'll just take them a bit longer. Maybe that's all the traitor needs, a little more time, and then it won't matter. I shifted awkwardly because I had no good answer for that. I know how you felt about Seifel, Campion. This must be tearing you up inside. Do you hate me for that? For liking her? That would be rather petty of me, wouldn't it? Especially now. She was one of the best of us. She was beautiful, too. Don't think I hadn't noticed. I can hardly blame you for admiring her. I'm lucky to have you. Whatever I might have felt about Seifel, it didn't even begin to compare. I know, I said, shushing him by placing a finger against his lips. You don't have to say it. You never have to say it. Just keep being here, all right? Don't ever go away. I'm not going anywhere, Campion said. Part 5. I held the letter in my hands. It was the finest paper I had ever touched, smooth as a puppy's ear and as delicately scented as a courtesan's pillow. It smelled of lilacs and almonds and the rare spices of the faraway islands, the archipelago that lay at the very edge of the mapped world, beyond the kingdom, beyond outlying empires, beyond the shield mountains, beyond the girdling seas, beyond the perilous leagues of white Kraken Ocean. The wax seal was a black coin embossed with the calculatedly unsettling emblem of Count Mordax, a portcullis made of bones. I broke the seal with my fingernail and folded open the crisp document, my heart anticipating the dire news I fully expected it to contain. I was not to be disappointed, if that is quite the turn of phrase to encompass my feelings. The letter was from my stepbrother, Mordax himself. His writing was as elegant and magisterial as ever. He wrote love letters the same way he wrote death warrants. This was neither. The letter informed me that my lady-in-waiting, still a prisoner in the Black Castle, would be put to death unless I revealed the whereabouts of Calidris. Not only would she be executed, but the manner of her death would be commensurate with my continued non-compliance. I could spare her by acting within hours. I could ease her torment by acting within the day. I could guarantee a slow and painful execution by delaying my response any longer than that. "I cannot do this," I told the chamberlain, Daubenton. He was standing in my council room, the heavy oak table straining under its burden of maps and plans of war, acres of heavy parchment and leather. The room was darkly vaulted, with small latticed windows to confound spies and assassins. Candles barely touched its sullen military gloom. Nothing pleasant had ever been schemed within these walls, only death and punishment. Next to Daubenton was the master-at-arms, Searless. "I had hoped not to betray Calidris. After all he has done for us," I said. Searless fingered the crimson gash of his old dueling scar.
"You could not betray Calidris even if you wished it, milady. Even my best spies have no idea where the sorcerer is hiding now. That was always as he wished it, to lose himself both to his enemies and his friends."
"Calidris must remain amongst men," I said. "That is his strength and his weakness. No other magician is as powerful as him, but magic is a curious fire. It pollutes the minds of those who would shape it. One magician may sense the mind of another magician, blazing like a beacon in an otherwise dark landscape. The only defense, the only manner in which a sorcerer may hide, is to surround himself with lesser minds. No one is entirely immune from the taint of magic. We all carry a little of it within us. Our minds do not blaze so brightly, but we may provide a kind of concealment to one such as Calidris. In cities, in towns, even in villages, he may swaddle the bright coal of his own mind in the dim embers of his fellow citizens. He cannot easily be found, even by another magician. That is his strength, but it is also a weakness, for it makes it hazardous for him to travel, even in the company of a small party. And if a man such as Mordax wishes to find Calidris, he need only put every village in the kingdom to the sword, until he has forced the magician to reveal himself."
"There have already been reports of raiding parties torching the villages and hamlets along the western flank of the Forest of Shadows," said Daubenton. "They rode horses from the east, and spoke in the coarse tongue of brigands."
I nodded heavily. "But we may safely assume Mordax's men were responsible. We may also assume that they will apply the same systematic approach to every village they suspect of harboring Calidris. Our army is weakened. We cannot defend every community on the map." I put down the hateful document, this vile piece of fragranced paper that had been touched and written on by my stepbrother. "I cannot let my people burn, even when the lady-in-waiting has been put to the sword. Do you imagine Count Mordax will leave us alone?"
"I fear milady is correct," Daubenton said. "But how does this change things? We cannot locate Calidris."
"I can," I said.
"How is that possible?" asked Searless.
"Because Ludmilla gave me the blueprints for her ships," I said.
Daubenton frowned. "Milady?"
I was ashamed at my childish outburst, though the words had tumbled from my mouth before I could stop them. Ludmilla Marcelin was a figment from my dreams, the princess of another realm, one of celestial argosies and palaces in the sky. She did not belong in daylight. "Forgive me," I said. "I babble nonsense, the product of too little sleep."
"Of course, milady," Searless said, "but concerning Calidris?"
"I can reach him. Before he left us, Calidris gave me a gift. From the folds of my dress I withdrew the embroidered rectangle of my sewing kit. Daubenton and Searless studied it warily, uncertain of my meaning. I opened the kit, spreading the two halves wide in my lap. The needles, pins, thimbles, and embroidery were as I had left them. "Milady," Daubenton said again. My hand moved along the arrayed needles until I reached the smallest of them all, the one I was careful never to use when I was sewing. I pulled it from its pocket. "This is what Calidris gave me," I said, holding the needle up for inspection. It glimmered in the wavering candlelight. "It looks like the others, but it is not the same. Calidris placed an enchantment on this needle. It is blood-bound."
"I am unfamiliar with the notion," Searless admitted.
"So was I until it was explained. It is magical cunning. Calidris knew he must make himself difficult to find. That is why he went into the world, to smother himself with the dull minds of ordinary men. But his wisdom told him that there might come a time when the kingdom had dire need of him again, a crisis so grave that Calidris must once more work his magic to save us."
"Calidris's magic nearly tore the world in two," Dorbenton said, the colour gone from his face.
"I felt the same way. Calidris's dark talents had opened a mouth into hell." "Then it may be magic powerful enough to hold the world in one piece, when something else would rip it asunder. Calidris knew this. He's no fool, and no one in the kingdom has a firmer appreciation of the risks of magic. But still he gave me this blood-bound needle. With it, I may summon him again. I have only to prick my skin to draw a bead of blood, and Calidris will hear my call."
"How?"
"An invisible needle will stab into his finger and draw his blood. When the needle pricks, he will turn his gaze towards the Palace of Clouds and know that I have need of him."
"You would do this?" Searless asked. "There is no other way," Dorbenton said.
"You did not sound so certain a moment ago," I said.
"Better his magic be loosed into the world than to watch the kingdom fall to Count Mordax's raiding parties." Dorbenton shrugged wearily. "It is a dark bargain, but I see no alternative."
"Because there is none," I said. "We must have Calidris."
"To give to Mordax, in return for the lady-in-waiting and the safety of our villages?" asked Searless. "Surely we have other choices. What of Relictus, the failed apprentice? He remains in our custody. Could he not help us now?"
"Calidris made me promise that I would never turn to Relictus, even in our darkest hour. He never trusted the apprentice. He said that his talents were dark and misshapen."
"Calidris could not have foreseen our present needs," Searless said.
"It is immaterial. I have no intention of giving Calidris to Mordax. The Count would never keep his side of the bargain. I know him better than anyone else. He and I were once to be married, you know."
"Milady, the Count is your step-brother," Dorbenton said tactfully.
Confusion addled my mind for a few heartbeats. I had been certain that the Count and I were destined for marriage, until shadowy politicking had made that betrothal an impossibility. How could I know his voice and mannerisms, his inability to keep a promise, if I had not moved in his circles with the intimacy of a lover-to-be?
"He used to come and play," I said,
trailing off as the absurdity of my statement sank home. "I remember his ship, his robots."
"Milady must sleep," Dorbenton said.
"She has been driving herself to exhaustion with her concern for her people." Searless just looked at me. I did not know if he had formed a judgment.
"Calidris must return to us," I said, with renewed firmness, "not to be traded for my lady-in-waiting, but to use his powers against Mordax. No adviser in the palace would trust our enemies in the Black Castle to hold to a bargain."
"That is true," Dorbenton admitted.
"I feel clear-headed now, resolute. The time has come."
"It must be Milady's decision," Searless said.
"It is," I answered, "always and forever." I pricked my finger with the blood-bound needle and drew a bauble of the purest scarlet. There was no pain. Somewhere in my kingdom, Calidris, the strongest of all magicians, felt more than his share.
Chapter 21.
"You're no fool," Mazarian said, her voice pitched to reach the audience even though it was the prisoner she was addressing. "You've been around, seen a few things here and there. You know exactly what I have in mind for you."
"So get it over with," Grosser said. "You're already boring me to death."
He had been moved into the open air, onto one of the largest balconies in the tower. He was out of stasis. Mazarian had failed with the Jertina Shatterling, who was now another pile of dust, but her efforts with Grosser had been more successful. As she had anticipated, his cabinet was in a better condition than the other three. He had weathered the transition to real time without complications.
and was now in Gentian hands, literally and metaphorically. Or at least he had been for a few moments, fearful that he might find a way to kill himself, or at least render himself incapable of being usefully interrogated. Mazerian had arranged for Grilser to be manhandled into a restraining box. It was an upright frame of complicated construction, a skeletal outline filled with aspic of machines, forming a translucent jellied rectangle into which Grilser, by now stripped of his clothes, was forcibly immersed. The box allowed him to breathe and communicate, but he was going nowhere. It was presumed that if he had been carrying an implanted suicide mechanism, he would already have triggered it inside the stasis cabinet, during one of the intervals when he had been dialed down for questioning. The sectioning apparatus was center stage, and the box in which Grilser was trapped formed part of it. Hovering above the box, arranged into an ordered circle, were rectangular panes of a glassy material, each of which was as tall and wide as the framework around the box. Along the top of each pane was a flanged grey bar containing levators and enough intelligence to follow Mazerian's instructions. All of this had been forged by makers, in accordance with ancient blueprints. The aspic had forced its way into his lungs, into contact with his nervous system. It was feeding him with air and information, allowing him to breathe, move within certain limits and hear what Mazerian was saying. We could see his chest rising and falling, his eyes following Mazerian as she strode up and down. "I've killed three of your colleagues," she said. "I was ready to kill you as well, without hesitation, but things are different now. One of us is gone. She was murdered, just when she was getting close to exposing vital information, so I'm not going to kill you. Not until I'm certain I've bled you dry, and by then maybe I'll have lost interest. You mean nothing to me beyond the information in your head, and I will find out what you know, piece by piece if necessary."
"You can do what you like. It won't get you anywhere."
Mazerian looked to one side.
"Lower the first pane."
At her instruction, one of the orbiting panes broke from the group and descended until it was suspended just above the top of the cabinet. For a moment it hung there, until a nod from Mazerian caused it to lower into the cabinet itself, piercing the invisible glass and parting the aspic in a clean descending line. It was only just possible to make out the pale edge of the descending pane. "You'll feel it cut its way through you," Mazerian told the prisoner. "It won't hurt as much as it should, since the nerve connections are reinstated almost as soon as they are broken. But there'll still be a tingling background of unpleasantness. It will feel like a sharp-edged cold front pushing through your soul. As it descends, you will know that part of you is on one side of that glass, and part of you on the other." The pain had begun to divide him at the skull, piercing him so that his face was on one side of the glass, his ears and the rear of his head on the other. It crept downwards at perhaps a centimetre a second, the progress smooth for the most part, but with occasional hesitations, as if it was encountering denser or more complex biological structures. I knew that the pain was only microns thick, yet it was isolating the two halves of him, severing them from each other as completely as if it had been a metal guillotine. What prevented him from dying, what allowed him to keep thinking, even as the pain knifed his brain into two halves, was that the glass was permitting essential biological functions to tunnel through itself, as if the divided surfaces were still contiguous. I gathered that very little biological material was actually passing through the glass without being completely disassembled down to atoms or basic molecules, incorporated into the glass's agile, constantly adapting matrix, and then conveyed and reassembled elsewhere, on one side or the other, in accordance with the circulatory patterns that had been interrupted. The same was true of the electrical and chemical signals associated with synaptic function. By now the glass had passed through his head and was beginning to divide him at the shoulders and upper torso. The expression on his face had altered subtly, in a way that might easily be mistaken for the effect of the play of light as clouds passed over the piazza. The aspic of machines was allowing him to move his facial muscles, just enough to register disquiet, and perhaps even horror, at what was being done to him. Even if he wished to talk now, it would make no difference to Mazerian. I watched, mesmerized and repelled, as the glass completed sectioning the prisoner. When the pane reached the base of the cabinet, it halted. Since we could no longer see the pale edges of the pane, the effect was as if the prisoner had been restored to his former integrity. This was illusory. Mazarian gestured towards the cabinet, and it partitioned itself into two halves, each of which contained one portion of the divided man. The two halves folded away from each other. The man opened for inspection like a lavishly illustrated book. The pane must have split itself into two thinner layers, each of which was holding back a wall of tissue, muscle, sinew, bone and pumping fluid, or pinks and whites and reds and livery purples. The visible detail in the two sections was identical, except that one was a precise mirror image of the other, a living mirror too, for the man was still alive, still breathing. We could see the rise and fall of his chest behind the glass, the outline of his pleural cavity, his heart pumping like the speeded-up opening and contraction of a flower. Mazarian allowed us to examine him a moment longer, then rotated the front section, the one that contained his face, until it was looking back at the rear section.
"This is you," she said, indicating the living anatomical chart he had become. "This is not a projection, but rather your own self, cut down the middle and trapped behind glass. It is necessary that you understand this. Indicate your assent by nodding. The aspic of machines will permit you this movement."
I suppose the man had no choice but to nod, or perhaps he was made to do so by the machine in which he was trapped. As his head bowed, the other half echoed the movement with no detectable delay. The action, as the half head tilted forward into the plane of the glass, revealed a squirming, ever-changing cross-section of skull and brain.
"This will be the last conscious movement you make," Mazarian said. "You will continue to breathe, and blood will continue to flow through your body, but you will remain fixed in position. You can, of course, still talk to me. Your intention to speak is all I need."
She looked away from the prisoner towards her audience, playing to the house. "The sectioning will continue until you have no physical existence, except as several hundred wafer-thin slices trapped under glass, and rest assured, I will go that far. You can halt that process at any time by giving us the information we seek, in a verifiable form."
"I have nothing to say to you," he answered,
his voice unchanged but strange nonetheless, given that it had emerged fully formed from only half a man. Mazarian nodded as if she had expected his response.
"I'd have been disappointed if you'd let us stop now," she said.
Two more panes lowered from the orbiting flock and came into hovering position above the prisoner's two halves, aligned in parallel with the first division. Mazarian sliced her prisoner again. Then she kept going, following a geometric progression. I turned to leave the piazza, imagining that I would be one of the first to do so, and realized that Perslane must have already departed. When it had been decreed that nothing more would be learned from Seifel's remains, her body was brought out into the open on a hovering platform. The platform tilted slightly forward so that the fact of her death and the evidence of her injuries were obvious to all. Seifel was much as she had been when found, except that her body had been arranged in a suggestion of repose. Visible in outline beneath a translucent sheet, her arms were at her sides, her legs had been straightened, the bones pushed back under her skin, the blood cleaned from her wounds, and although she did not have much of a face left to look with, the angle of her head suggested that she was looking expectantly upwards into the evening sky. Four shatterlings accompanied the platform until it came to rest over a table-sized block and lowered slowly into place. The rest of us formed a circle, holding torches in the air, and then advanced slowly until we were gathered in a small crowd around Seifel. There were 50 of us present, rather than 51, for, as always, one shatterling, it happened to be Medic on this occasion, was away from Naume on survey duties. But there were 51 torches, a flame for every survivor, with the spare one being passed from hand to hand in symbolic recognition of the shatterling who was not present at the funeral. Our witnesses, the shatterlings from other lines, our guests and the dignitaries from Ymir and the other cities of Naume, surrounded us at a respectful distance, standing on a circle of raised flooring. They were soberly dressed. Our clothes also befitted the occasion, We all wore black garments, devoid of ostentation, save for embroidered black flowers that were all but invisible. Paslane's hair was combed back from her forehead, secured by a simple, flower-shaped clasp. She wore no makeup or jewelry, nor did anyone else. The air was cold, but our clothes had been forbidden from warming us or assisting with the burden of the torches. Mine weighed heavy in my hand, as if the more it burned, the heavier it became. I was not surprised that Bettany had chosen to speak for Cyphel, but for once I did not begrudge his putting himself forward. I had known Cyphel as well as anyone present, even if I had not been one of her closest friends. Her closest friends had died in the ambush. At best, I only counted as a close acquaintance. I felt a sense of obligation towards her, a conviction that there were aspects of her character I understood better than anyone else. But I had no wish to hurt Paslane by dwelling on my feelings for Cyphel. Nothing had ever existed between us except the possibility of something, and now even that was over. Besides, my knowledge of line traditions was not as exhaustive as it might have been. As we had told the robots, funerals of this kind were exceptionally rare events. There was not usually a body involved, and there was often no conclusive evidence that the Shatterling in question was really dead. Bettany kept his speech brief. He said that although Cyphel's death would cast a long shadow over what remained of the line, and that the circumstances of her death were still under investigation and might yet lead to unpleasant revelations, that was no reason not to celebrate the life she had lived. She had seen and done glorious things. She had touched countless lives. She had carried a thread of memory across 6 million years. She had been loved and admired and envied. He spoke of a dozen or so significant milestones in her life, blowing the dust off events that had happened many circuits ago. I had steeled myself to be annoyed by Bettany's words, but, to my own lingering irritation, I found nothing to disagree with. Afterwards, when Cyphel's life had been played out across the sky, I thought back to what he had said and found nothing I would have changed, nothing I would have amplified or amended. His summing up of her life had the pure simplicity of a haiku. It had been honed and polished, and it was delivered with conviction and respect, and something of the same love he had mentioned in connection with her. I was still resentful of the way Bettany had taken command of the line, but when he spoke for Cyphel, I discarded any thought, however improbable it had seemed, that he might have been her murderer. When the words had been spoken, Bettany pulled the sheet down from Cyphel's neck, revealing the true extent of her injuries. Cyphel was naked except for the rings on her fingers. We all flinched, even those of us who had already seen her body after the fall. Then Bettany handed his torch to another Shatterling, and from one pocket he produced a thick black tube of aspic of machines. He cupped one hand and squeezed a dollop into the palm, then smeared the aspic onto Cyphel's forearm, where the skin had been ruptured when a bone had pushed its way through. Then he stood back a little and pressed the tube into the thick fingers of Weld, who had been standing next to him. Bettany reclaimed his torch and took hold of Weld's, while the other Shatterling squeezed aspic onto his palm and daubed it onto Cyphel, this time across the dented arc of her brow. Weld then passed the aspic to Charlock, who rubbed the translucent, glistening paste across Cyphel's belly. So it continued, until all who were present had taken their turn. I do not know why I was the last, whether it just worked out that way or whether the group had arrived at the collective decision that it must fall to me to make the final daub. By then the only visible part of Cyphel that had not been covered was the smashed travesty of her face. As my hand applied the aspic, my fingers touching hard ridges of bone and cartilage where there should have been skin, I shuddered with the effort of not breaking down into sobs. Then I took my torch from Purslane and stood back, my hand still shaking. The circle had widened, opening space around the reclining form. By the time I had finished, the aspic had already begun to do its work. It was infiltrating Cyphel's body as far as it needed to go to undo a given injury. Her forearm stiffened momentarily, the fingers of her hand tremoring as if Cyphel were dreaming. Around the point where the bone had come through, the hole in her flesh began to seal over. The dent in her brow smoothed itself out and the recognizable structure of a nose began to appear beneath the glistening mask. The machines were not restoring Seifeld to life. It was much too late for that. Not that an illusion of life would have been beyond them. They could have animated her corpse, repaired cells, and coaxed their metabolic cycles to start up again. They could have made her sit up and smile, made her walk and talk and laugh, but there would have been no mind behind those eyes, or at least none that retained anything of Seifel. As the process continued and the figure on the couch began to look less and less like a broken corpse, and more like a sleeping woman, a squadron of our ships moved into position above Ymir. They were not orbiting, but holding station above this fixed point on Neume, just beyond the ionosphere. The sun had long since fallen below the horizon, but the ships were so high up that the sun's rays still caught the edges of their hulls, picking them out like a fleet of new moons, edged in scimitar-bright lines of silver and gold and fiery red. The ships arranged themselves into a square formation, spanning thousands of kilometers of space. Then they activated their impassors and began to project and shape the fields so that they pushed down into the ionosphere, tangling with the planet's native magnetosphere. Squeezing, crimping, folding and stretching the field lines of the magnetosphere, the ships began to paint the sky with auroral colors. Curtains of light, the most delicate ruby or green, rippled from horizon to horizon. The colors intensified until the ships were almost hidden behind the display, silent puppeteers retreating from view. They stripped ions from their hulls and injected them into the atmosphere to stain and dye their handiwork. The curtains flickered and shimmered and intertwined, dancing with increasing swiftness, different hues being introduced, until shapes became apparent. The shapes formed images. We were being shown a sequence of pictures drawn from Seifel's strands, sampled from those stored inside her ship. There were landscapes and cities, moons and planets, as rich a cross-section of galactic history as any of us had tasted. Seifel was absent from most of the images, but that only served to make her presence in some of them the more poignant. She was usually caught with her back to us, a distant figure standing on some cliff or high building, with one hand on her hip and another shielding her eyes from the sun, lost in the rapture of scale and scenery, drunk on the very idea of being human, a monkey who had hit the big time. Her hair was the electric white of a comet's tail, streaming back from her brow as if fingered by a caress of photonic pressure. As we watched the episodes play across the canvas that the ships had made of the sky, the aspic of machine slowly undid Seifel's injuries. At last the glistening call completed its work and slithered off her, awaiting its next duty. Turned gold under the light of our torches, Seifel lay uncorrupted. Her expression was one of patient serenity. Her eyes were closed, but she looked as if it would only take a raised voice, a careless laugh, to jolt her from the carefree drowse in which she lay. The platform began to rise again, detaching from the block where it had rested. At first it rose so slowly that it took at least a minute for her body to rise higher than my line of sight. Only then did the platform begin to quicken its ascent, rising into the air with increasing swiftness. The torch, which had felt so heavy until then, began to lighten. There was a point where it weighed nothing at all, and then a moment later it was trying to escape from my hand, as if being pulled from above on an invisible thread. All around me, the other shatterlings stretched their arms and redoubled their grips, anxious to retain their torches until the appointed moment. "Release," Bettany said, very quietly, and we all let go. The timing was impeccable, for the 51 torches rose in a flame-lit ring, maintaining elegant formation until they had caught up with the rising platform. Lowering our hands to our sides, our muscles still aching from the effort, we watched the dark rectangle of the platform become smaller and smaller, until it was only by the diminishing circle of fire that we could judge where it was. It would take a while for Seifel to reach space. All that remained was for us to continue watching the display of scenes from her life, reflecting on how she had touched all of us in one way or another. I felt solidarity with almost everyone else present, including Bettany, including Miserion, including those other shatterlings whom I felt had been complicit in Perslane's punishment. But somewhere amongst us, I felt certain, was someone who was not sorry about what had happened to Seifel. In every grave face I tried to read a sign of masked emotions, of quiet satisfaction that she had been disposed of so efficiently, but I saw nothing but sincere grief. We were not just mourning Saifel, I knew. This was her night, her funeral, but the fact of it had flung wide an emotional door on our hearts that had been locked until now. This was the night when we first took account of the more than 800 chatterlings who had died in the ambush. They would all be honored in the traditional way when the time was right. They would all be accorded memorials, but that did not mean we could not begin to grieve for them now. As the realization of what had been done to us hit me with renewed force, as I began to truly apprehend the scale of that crime, a realization that it had taken the particularity of Seifel's funeral to force upon me, I felt the coldest of all chills pass through me. Not long after, Seifel reached space and the platform tilted to release her for her long fall back to Naomi's atmosphere. We watched as she scratched a line of glorious fire across the sky, a line that began faintly, flared to a ribbon of pastel blue, reached a climax that had us narrowing our eyes, then faded slowly away before splitting into fingers of dulling red. Seifel giving up every atom of her body, every atom of her existence, all that she had ever been, all that she ever would have been, until all that remained of her was the figment we held in our memories, no more and no less. Long after she had faded, the ships continued playing images of her life, until that too dimmed, and the planet's magnetosphere was allowed to relax back to its normal configuration. The squadron, dark now, pulled away into parking orbit. The audience of Shatterlings, guests, and Demirians at last began to disperse, shivering even as our clothes were finally allowed to warm us. Seifel's funeral was over. We had honored her. Now it was time to get on with being Gentian Line. Later that evening, after Perslane had gone to sleep, I stood alone on one of the balconies. I was thinking of all the pieces of Seifel's life that had played across the sky, trying to fit them into some kind of order, wondering what she would have made of it all had she been one of the spectators. Then I became aware of a heavy trudging presence, a sound like carpet scuffing on stone. I turned around with an empty wine glass in my hand, lost somewhere along the drunken, ill-defined border between nostalgic remembrance and bitter, spiraling melancholy. It was Ugarit Panth, the elephantine being I had spoken to shortly after our arrival on Naomi. I raised the glass in welcome. "Hello, Ambassador. How did you like the funeral?" He stopped a few meters from me, but still close enough that his trunk could have swiped my face.
"It was very moving, Shatterling," he said,
his human-looking mouth moving beneath that long, wrinkled, faintly disgusting appendage. "She was one of the best of us. I'm going to miss her a lot."
"As much as you'd miss your civilization if it ceased to exist?"
It was difficult for him to look at me head-on. His eyes were set in the sides of his skull, not the front of his face. He had to look at me askance, alternating between one eye and the other as if he wanted to balance the demand on his brain hemispheres. I tried to push aside the mental fog induced by the wine. "There are individuals who matter more to me than Gentian Line, yes. If I didn't realize that before, I realize it now."
"It's easy to see that now, with your line pushed almost to the point of extinction."
Something in his tone put me on edge. I took a step back from the balcony's railing, Seifel's long fall flashing through my mind. The roving ambassador of the Consentiency of the Thousand Worlds was a huge, ponderous creature, weighing about 20 times more than me, even before one allowed for his heavy-looking red armor and ornamental metalwork. I was prone to clumsiness when drunk. What he could do in a similar state of intoxication did not bear thinking about. I even began to wonder if the Emirians had designed their balconies for such massive individuals.
"Extinction's never good," I said, with an over-emphatic smile. "No, it's not."
Ugarit Panth took another step closer to me, 4 steps, in fact, one for each of his tree-thick legs. All of a sudden I got the full-bore stink of his breath in my face. It was like opening a warm oven full of rotting vegetables.
"You very nearly blew it, Shatterling. I bet you thought you were in the clear."
"Nearly blew what?"
"The first time we met, you commiserated with me."
"Did I?"
"You were sorry that my civilization had been wiped out by the failure of a star dam."
I got that wrong, though. I was thinking of the pantropic nexus, different civilization altogether. I wasn't even in the right spiral arm.
Ah, but you were. Your mistake was puzzling to me. You were so certain, so genuine in your sympathies. It began to prey on my mind.
I looked around, desperately hoping that another shatterling would come to my rescue. But it was a mistake.
Don't compound your error by lying even more. I tried consulting Gentian Line's troves later that night. For some reason, my guest access was temporarily blocked. In the morning, it was all excused away. A problem with the security settings caused when they were altered to allow for the latest batch of survivors.
Well then, nothing to worry about.
You would say that, but at the next opportunity I checked again. I looked up the entry for my civilization, the Consentiency. There was a star dam, as I knew full well. Gentian Line installed it. Reassuringly, there was no record of it having detonated prematurely.
That's that settled, I said, trying to strike a note of finality, so that we could change the subject.
Still, I had my doubts. Couldn't put them to bed. I looked up the entry for the Pantropic Nexus. Can't say I'd ever heard of them, but there they were, along with a note to the effect that the entire civilization had been wiped out during the premature collapse of a Gentian star dam. His vast grey brow, the part of it visible between the plates of his armor, wrinkled impressively.
It's the only one that's ever failed.
You're absolutely certain of that.
It's not something we take lightly. The pride of the line rests on our handiwork. Star dams are what we do. Even if we allow for that one failure, we've spared billions of lives that would otherwise have been lost. But that doesn't make it excusable. Not at all.
I'm very glad to hear you say that, Shatterling. But still my qualms weren't entirely silenced. It occurred to me, suppose that the Consentiency star dam had failed after all, would Gentian Line be in a hurry to tell me?
We wouldn't lie about something like that. If the dam failed, we'd admit culpability.
But what about a white lie? What if Gentian Line were primarily concerned with my mental well-being? What if they didn't think I could take the truth? That I was now alone in the universe, the last of my kind, the last living representative of the Consentiency. What if they thought the truth might actually kill me? They might lie then, don't you think?
But the Pantropic Nexus?
The ambassador waved his trunk dismissively, a lie that had to be made up on the spur of the moment to cover a momentary indiscretion.
But the troves?
For all I know, the data in the troves was manipulated to keep the truth from me. I was only looking at local copies. The versions aboard your ships might have told me something totally different. I'd have no way of knowing, would I? Short of casting aspersions on the integrity of Gentian Line, I'd have no choice but to take the information at face value.
Put it like that, I suppose you're right.
Still, there are always loopholes. And because the matter was causing me such vexation, I remembered something. You Shatterlings place great stock in your universal actuary. It's how you plan your circuits, working out where you want to go, on the basis of information that may be hundreds of thousands of years stale.
It's that, or start flipping coins.
Well, perhaps you'd be better off flipping coins. I talked one of you into giving me access to the UA, you see.
My blood cooled to superfluid helium. Who'd that be, then?
Oh, don't blame him. Gallingale had no idea what I was after. We were talking. I've talked with most of you, and I bent the conversation around to the subject of the UA. I feigned interest. For some reason, I'd been gently dissuaded from further inquiries, but Gallingale was strangely receptive. I think I flattered him with my attention.
The idiot, I said under my breath.
Oh, but it really wasn't his fault. I can be extraordinarily persuasive, and he wasn't to know I had an ulterior motive. I told him I was interested in the UA as a thing unto itself. I didn't let him know I was keen to see what he'd had to say on the subject of the Consentiency. But you'd know, wouldn't you? The UA wasn't altered to agree with the troves. None of you ever thought I'd look that far into your secrets.
I let out an exhausted sigh, secretly relieved, despite myself. Is there any point in keeping up the pretense, Ambassador?
None whatsoever.
If it's any consolation, my sympathy was genuine.
I never doubted it.
I'd not been briefed. Bettany's fault, I suppose. He should have warned me that certain conversational topics were strictly out of bounds, but he must have been keeping that lie going for so long he'd forgotten all about it. I shrugged. Or my fault for being a blabbermouth, not reading the situation, wading in where I shouldn't have. I'm sorry, Ambassador. You shouldn't have found out this way. But I hope you understand that the line did have your best interests at heart. This wasn't about excusing our mistake.
The wiping out of an entire civilization. A mistake.
We've saved hundreds, I said. I'm sorry if that sounds cold, but that's the only possible perspective. It doesn't diminish the tragedy. You have every right to feel angry.
Anger doesn't begin to cover it, Shatterling. I thought you'd have the sense to realize that.
Ambassador,
I just thought you all ought to know. You can stop lying to me now.
He turned around, shuffling on the flat discs of his feet. Beneath his armor, his skin swung in obscene wattled folds. I watched him trudge back indoors, then looked into the empty depths of the wine glass, seeking solace. Chalk up another sparkling success to tact and diplomacy, I said to myself. That night, Sifel came to me again. I was in her room, lying on her couch, watching as she squeezed the aspic of machines onto her hand and made the webwork of black lines. But instead of holding the hand over my head as she dragged my memories into daylight, Sifel just brushed my hair and lowered her face until she was about to kiss my cheek. Then she whispered into my ear, "You always liked me. I always liked you, too. But now you have to do something for me. I want you to pay attention." I woke up. In the morning, I caught up with Galingale before he had found his way to the breakfast table. As I tugged his sleeve, he looked around with an eager, expectant expression, as if I might be a lover come to give him a morning kiss. The optimism dropped from his face like a landslide. "You silly fool," I said, looking into his one good eye. He blinked. "Bit early for insults, isn't it? Make it quick, because I'm on patrol duty today. As soon as I've had my coffee, I'm shuttling up to Midnight Queen." I steered him away from the others. "Last night I had a very interesting chat with Ugarit Panth, you know, the ambassador who isn't supposed to know that his entire civilization no longer exists."
"Oh, him?
It seems you let him have a look through the universal actuary. He wanted to know how it worked. The sociometric models, the statistical methods, all harmless stuff. He used it to look up the entry on the consentiency of the thousand worlds." Galingale brushed fingers through the stiff white bristles of his hair.
"And?"
"The entry hadn't been changed, you idiot. It didn't agree with the local troves. Now he knows exactly what happened. The UA gave a 0% likelihood for the consentiency still existing in the future because it's already gone." He mouthed a silent curse, the realization hitting him like a physical slap. He glanced at the nearby breakfast table, the other Shatterlings taking their places. Everyone was still dressed in black after Sifel's funeral. By line tradition, even the fruits and breads and drinks were black.
"Who else knows?"
"I've no idea. I was alone when he came up to me. I mentioned it to Purslane this morning, but it won't go further than her. What I don't know is who else Ugarit Panth has talked to. I'd better have a word." "With Bettany or the elephant?"
"I don't know. Both, maybe. Fuck!"
"Fuck indeed."
"You're not exactly blameless here, Campion. Everything was going fine until you commiserated with the hapless bastard."
"I hadn't been forewarned. Silly me, but I completely failed to read the subliminal signals Bettany and the rest of you were putting out." Seeing the dread draining the color from his face, I softened my tone. "Look, I'm not going to rat you out. It was an honest mistake, and anyone could have made it. I genuinely didn't put two and two together. I just assumed the UA would have been synced with the truths. Should have checked first, of course, but fuck! How was Ugarit Panth? Did he seem edgy to you?"
"More annoyed than anything else."
"We don't want him committing suicide on us. I don't know if Bettany told you, but they have a habit of walking around with bombs inside them. If he went up here... He wouldn't do that. He's a rational being. But there's no telling what that kind of news could do to him. Where is he now?
No idea. I touched a finger to my brow, feigning absent-mindedness. You know, in all the excitement I forgot to attach a tracking device to him.
Someone has to talk to Bettany.
His dread turned to terror. I can't do this, Campion. He'll say, why me? What have I got to do with it? I'll be censured. Worse.
Could anyone tell that your UA was accessed?
No, don't think so. Unless I admit to it. Unless the ambassador admits to it.
Then I'll talk to Bettany. I'm already involved, so I can't dig myself a deeper hole. He seemed surprised by my offer, as if there had to be a trap somewhere in it.
What'll you see?
Just that Ugarit Panth told me he'd worked things out. I won't mention the UA or you.
What if they find the ambassador and he talks?
Can't do anything about that, I'm afraid. But even if he does, you'll be all right. It was a stupid thing to do, but it was an innocent mistake.
Of course.
Some of the color had started creeping back into his skin.
Thank you, Campion. You're right. I was an idiot. I should have thought things through. But he was just so damn persuasive.
I guess if we're all still standing here, he probably isn't going to blow himself up. Not today, anyway.
I think you're trying to reassure me, but...
I patted him on the back. Let's have breakfast. Looks lovely, doesn't it? I'm sorry about Saifal. I could still see her in my dream, whispering into my ear.
Pay attention.
We're all sorry about her. But before I could sit down at the table, next to Perslane, she was talking to Charlock. I was detained by an Emirian official.
Campion?
Asked the delicate little creature.
Yes, I said. Begging your pardon, Shatterling, but you are urgently requested at the office of Magistrate Jindabyne.
Perslane had seen what was happening. She rose from the table, brushing black crumbs from her black blouse. Has there been a development?
I can't say, the Emirian answered, just that you're to come with me.
Chapter 22. When we arrived, we found Mr. Jinx sharing Jindabyne's office. The magistrate and the scientist were sitting at the same desk, one on either side, taking turns to inhale from the bubbling urn that sat on it.
Something's happened, Jindabyne informed us.
Mr. Jinx handed her the mouthpiece. She placed it between her lips without wiping it clean.
It would appear that your little funeral ceremony had an unexpected result. You did things with the atmosphere that we normally wouldn't have sanctioned.
We had permission, I said, preparing to bristle. Jindabyne raised a calming hand.
That's not in dispute. If we had known the scope of your intended activities, we might have demurred. But the fact is that we let you go ahead.
Is there a problem? Campion asked.
That depends, Jinx said.
You appear to have stimulated a response from the spirit of the air. When it does things, especially when it manifests at the observation platforms, it normally does so during the hours of daylight. Overnight, it manifested in darkness. For us, that's a problem. We don't like to see evidence of the spirit being agitated, disturbed, roused from its normal patterns. Civilizations have fallen because they got on the wrong side of the spirit. We don't want to be one of them.
What happened? I asked.
Last night, a few hours after the cessation of your funeral service, the magistrate said, the spirit moved into position above the observation platform you were allowed to visit with the injured robot. We had been tracking its movements, of course. The fact of the spirit's presence in this sector wasn't a surprise. But we did not expect it to pass directly over the tower, and we certainly didn't expect it to stop.
Hesperus is back. Please tell me Hesperus is back.
Well? Campion asked. The magistrate sucked indulgently on the mouthpiece. Observations indicate the presence of a golden object on the plinth. The golden object is man-shaped and man-sized. It was not there yesterday.
We have to get out there, I told Campion.
I think we'd best ask permission first, he said.
You have permission, the magistrate said. Why else would we have called you here? But the spirit is not far away.
You will retrieve the robot immediately. If you fail to do so within the next hour, the robot's remains will be deemed property of the Scientific Study Council. They belong to the machine people, I said. Not anymore they don't. The robot stopped being a machine person when the spirit took him apart. The thing that has appeared on the platform is an artifact of the spirit. It just happens to look like the machine you thought you knew. It is very doubtful that any of the atoms in it are the same as those it originally contained.
We probably shouldn't quibble, Campion said. The magistrate looked at me sternly.
No, you shouldn't. Go now, recover the robot's remains. Do with them as you will. We will leave it to you to inform the other robots of this development, and afterwards, please, show no further interest in the spirit, ever.
We won't, I said.
When you say remains,
we mean what we say. The observations show that the robot appears just the way it was when you left it, except that it is no longer fused with the remains of the ship. In every other respect, it is no more alive now than it was then. Whatever you hoped to achieve, you have failed. 5 minutes later, we were speeding away from Ymir in a flyer, pushing the little craft to its limits. We said very little to each other on the journey. If our hearts had been lifted by the news of Hesperus's return, our hopes had been just as quickly dashed by the description of his condition. The cameras monitoring the platform had detected no signs of life in the golden figure, which had not moved since the spirit's departure. As the dunes sped under us, I realized that, of all the outcomes I had considered, this was the one I had thought least likely, that Hesperus would return, but not be changed. I had imagined the spirit repairing him, or transforming him into something new and strange, and I had imagined him never returning at all. But to be taken apart, to be pulled into the mass of that cloud consciousness for days, to become a part of it, only to be put back exactly the way he was, had always seemed pointless. And yet the evidence of that golden form could not be ignored.
Perhaps he just needs time to recover, Campion said, touching my hand, like a patient coming out of surgery, on a planet where they still cut people open with knives and lasers.
You're trying to be kind, and I appreciate it, but I don't think you should raise my hopes.
I'm just saying, there's a lot we don't know about Hesperus. We shouldn't rule anything out. If the spirit gave him back to us, it's for a reason.
Because it played with him, took him apart like a toy, and now that it knows how he works, it got bored and put him back together again.
Without fixing him first.
We don't know how the spirit thinks. Maybe it didn't see Hesperus the way we did, as a being in need of help.
Soon we were close enough to see him clearly, as I brought the flyer in for landing.
He was on the plinth where we had left him, lying on his back, completely motionless. Even as the flyer passed over him, he remained unmoving. The only change since we had last seen him was the absence of the fused mass that had connected him to the remains of Vespertine. The spirit had obviously understood enough to see that the mass did not belong with Hesperus, and it had repaired the parts of him that had been lost or concealed within that mass. But it had evidently not taken the extra step of restoring him to life. We parked the flyer and got out. Campion fished a set of levators from the rear compartment and pushed them through the air ahead of him until we reached the plinth. I knelt down to examine Hesperus, running a hand over the golden prominence of his chest.
"He's perfect again," I said quietly,
unwilling to disturb the sleeping form.
"There's no sign of damage at all. Even his arms are the same size now. I don't think there's any human flesh inside him anymore."
"It did all this, but it didn't make him live again."
"There are still lights in his head. There's still something going on inside him."
"But no more than what was there earlier."
"This isn't the way I thought it would happen. I thought if we got him back, everything would be right."
Campion attached the levators and lifted Hesperus from the plinth. He remained completely rigid, his limbs stiff, even though they were not supported. He might as well have been cast from a single piece of metal. I scowled at the horizon, but there was nothing there. I felt angry and reproachful, as if I had been let down, as if there had ever been a bargain between us and the spirit of the air.
"We'd best be going," Campion said.
I turned my face away because I did not want him to see my tears.
Chapter 23. Mazerian had arranged the 256 slices of Grilse into a floor-covering mosaic, 16 tiles to a side. The tiles were arranged according to a complicated scheme, one that looked random but was in fact much cleverer than that. The governing principle was that no adjoining tiles on the floor should correspond to adjoining slices of the original body. The effect was that one tile might contain a full body slice, showing the human form in profile, whereas the next one to it might contain only disconnected islands. The tiles were illuminated from below, and all were still oozing with slow, labored life. Fluids flowed sluggishly like rivulets of oil trapped between sheets of glass. His lungs expanded and contracted, the rhythmic movement echoing across many tiles in the arrangement. Between the tiles, framing them in a grid, was a series of narrow stone walkways. It looked for all the world like an arrangement of rectangular fish ponds in a formal garden, with strange, pulsating blooms lying on the dark water. Mazerion was striding down one of the walkways as we arrived, an energy pistol swinging easily from one hand. She was in the middle of hectoring Grilse, going over the same questions she had already asked him dozens of times. "My time is not limited," she said. "Yours, sadly, is growing shorter by the hour. I can keep chipping away at you until you've got less nervous system than a crayfish." She raised the energy pistol, made a micro-adjustment to its yield dial, and directed it at the pane to her right. "Can you feel any difference yet, Grilse? Am I speeding up? Are your thoughts turning foggier? Is it becoming more and more difficult to remember how you got here, why you ended up in our custody?" Screening her eyes with her free hand, she squeezed the trigger of the energy pistol, directing a lance of crimson light into the pane. She had aimed at his head. The pane did not shatter, but the weapon bored a neat hole through it into the cross-section of Grilse's brain, the tissue crisping back in a dark-edged, widening circle. "Any difference now, Grilse? You won't have felt that, but I just took out a few billion brain cells. You've hundreds of billions more, but we both know it's not an inexhaustible supply. The pains will route functional pathways around the damage, but they won't restore the memories you just lost. The unfortunate thing is, you won't necessarily remember losing them. You'll just feel emptier, more dispersed, like a room being cleared of furniture." His voice boomed loud. "I have told you everything I know." "I don't believe you." "Why do you imagine I was told more than I absolutely needed to know for the purposes of the operation?" "You wouldn't, unless you instigated it, which is at least a theoretical possibility. Until I know more about the structure and extent of the House of Suns, that's a possibility I can't discount." Mazerian hop-skipped to another pane, 6 rows to her right. "In any case, I still don't think you've told me everything you were told, even if you're not the linchpin." She aimed the nozzle of the energy pistol again, and shot into his abdomen. This time Grilse screamed. Across the mosaic, the slices squirmed under their prisons of glass. "Yes," Mazerian said approvingly, "a good cluster of nerves there. That must have really hurt. Maybe it's still hurting."
"She's out of control," I whispered to Purslane.
This we knew.
I looked around the scattered audience until I spotted Aconite, Valerian, and the other Shatterlings who were supposed to be keeping an eye on Mazerian's antics. Still in their funeral clothes, they formed a huddle of black. Bettany was only a row or two behind them, sitting next to Charlock.
"Wait here," I said.
"Aren't you in enough trouble?"
They forbade me from entering the interrogation room. We're outdoors now. I made my way to Aconite and the others while Mazerian continued tormenting Grilse. I had crossed only half the distance when I heard the crack of another energy discharge. No screaming this time, which meant she must have taken out another cluster of brain cells.
"Campion," Aconite said, patting an empty space next to him. "Take a seat, old man. She's on fine form, isn't she?"
"For a lunatic."
"She's displaying a certain zeal. Would we want any less of her?"
"She's husked 3 prisoners. You'll be lucky if there's anything left of Grilse by the end of the day."
"He knows that as well. Can't you see that he's on the verge of confessing?"
"He's on the verge of not having a language center.
Valerian coughed and said, in not much more than a murmur,
"Campion may have a point. We've given her a very long leash. She means well, and we all feel the same way about Grilsa. But the only thing that matters is getting information out of him. We can't let personal feelings endanger line security."
"You think we should reel her in?"
Melitot asked, her sentence punctuated by another energy discharge. "That won't look good, not in front of our guests."
"This isn't looking great either," I said. "From where I'm sitting, it looks a lot like line-sanctioned torture purely for the sake of it."
"And how would you run things, Campion?" asked Bettany, who had left his seat to join us. "I'm sure you're brimming with suggestions."
"I'd take that gun out of her hands to begin with. You can sever the data connections between those panes without destroying any physical patterns. If you want to make a point, do it that way. Grilsa won't know any different. He still feels bits of himself dropping away. The plus side of that method, however, is that you can always put him back together again if you don't get results. If he gives us nothing while we whittle him down to nothing, regardless of the method we use, he's hardly likely to behave differently the second time around," Aconite said. I shrugged. "So make it real the second time, or the third. But at least try it that way first. Call his bluff. See how close to the bone he's prepared to take things. Maybe he is on the verge of cracking, but the way Mazerion's going, it may be too late by the time he does."
"You really are determined to undermine this investigation," Bettany said.
I shook my head, more exhausted than angry.
"No, I fully endorse any activity that might get reliable data out of Grilsa. If I believe taking an axe to those panes would do the job, I'd be the first in line, but this isn't going to work."
I tried to look deep into his eyes, anxious to connect with the reasonable, rational man I had always believed him to be. He was ambitious, but never misguided.
"Bettany, you know this is wrong. I listened to you talk about Cyphel last night."
He glanced away with a sneer.
"I knew you'd find something to object to."
I had no objections whatsoever. What you said about her was perfect. I stood there and thanked the stars you were the one speaking, not me. You did her justice. The silence that opened between us seemed to last 1,000 years. The other Shatterlings had pulled away, giving us the space to speak in private.
"I thought you wouldn't approve," he said eventually.
"It was good. It was right and true. If Cyphel were here, she'd tell you the same thing."
"I just wanted to say the things that needed to be said. I didn't know Cyphel as well as you, but I know she wouldn't have tolerated anything that wasn't absolutely true, absolutely to the point. She didn't want her life embroidered or romanticized."
"You hit the right note." I sighed, conscious that I was treading a narrow course between alienating him forever and bringing him around to my point of view. After the ceremony, I knew I'd been wrong about you. Because of what happened with Purslane, it had crossed my mind, just crossed it mind, that maybe you had more to do with all of this than any of us realized. I swallowed hard. Then when Cyphel died...
"You thought I was implicated?"
"It was stupid, but one of us must be responsible for her death. I'm sorry that I allowed my suspicions to fall on you, even for an instant. But that's what happened." Now I was finding it difficult to speak. My chest was rising and falling as if I had just climbed a mountain. "You licensed Mazerion to continue with this interrogation. I began to wonder whether maybe you wanted her to fail."
"So that the information wouldn't come out?"
"Surely you can see why I might think that." Bettany's eyes gave no clue to his opinion of me. The processes of his mind might have been going on light years away for all that they showed in his face. "And now?" he asked, equably enough. The speech changed everything. "I could still be your murderer. A few well-chosen words, easily faked. But you didn't fake them."
"No," he said, after a lengthy pause. "They weren't faked. It was hard for me to talk about Cyphel. Harder still knowing that the person who killed her was probably only a few paces away."
"Then we agree on that." I turned to face the square with Mazerion and her array of luminous, squirming panes. "Which is why this has to stop, before she goes too far. Mazerion isn't the murderer, but she's not doing us any favors. I understand her hatred, her need for revenge, but now isn't the time or the place." There was another discharge from the energy pistol. Grilsa screamed again.
Mazarian, Bettany said, raising his voice so that it rang across the open space. Would you mind stopping for a moment? She spun around with vivid rage in her eyes, the pistol almost aimed at us. Here there were no safeguards. Unless the weapon had been instructed not to fire on Gentian shatterlings, it would only take a twitch of her finger to wipe out another five or six of us. Is there a problem, shatterling Bettany? Not at all, Mazarian. Despite his best efforts, there was still a quaver in his voice. I just think this might be a good time to pause, to take stock, to assess what we've learned before continuing. We've learned nothing. Nonetheless, it might still be wise to review our approach, to see if there aren't any refinements we might make. To my considerable relief, Mazarian lowered the pistol and twisted its yield dial to what I presumed was the safety setting. She let go of the weapon and it hovered in the air where she had left it. Then she stalked over to us. This is unacceptable. I was making progress. You were getting nowhere, I said. She glared at Bettany. I thought Campion was banished from the interrogation. That was different, I said. This is a public space. Banish me and you'll have to banish the Emirians as well. She ignored me, directing her remarks at Bettany. Grilsa was beginning to crack. I could feel it. The problem is that we don't know how long you'll have to keep drilling holes in him before he starts talking, Bettany said. He's a finite resource. We don't have another Grilsa backed up somewhere for when you finish with this one. I only need one of them. I'm afraid he's talking sense, Aconite said, offering her a conciliatory smile. You've done a fine job until now, and we're all grateful to you for that, but the time's come to try something else. Bettany shot me a glance, then looked back at Mazarian. Can Grilsa hear me now? He asked quietly. No, I turned off his auditory feed when you interrupted me. There'll be no more physical harm inflicted upon him, not until we've exhausted every other possibility. Set the yield on your pistol low enough that it won't penetrate the pane. We'll simulate damage by shutting down the data connections between his slices. He'll know the difference, Bettany. He won't feel pain. Then you'll have to make do without it. He'll still feel himself being deleted, slice by slice. That's got to be unpleasant enough without adding pain into the equation. He'll know the process is reversible. Not for certain he won't. There'll still be that doubt, especially if you keep discharging the pistol. At the moment, there's a chance he could be put together again, a walking, talking human being. Keep deleting pains, and he'll be like a book with half its pages torn out. There'll come a point when he'll have lost too much to be reconstructed, and he'll know that. Mazarian did not look convinced, but neither did she look as if she was ready for a showdown with Bettany and the others. They were offering her a way of saving face before the audience, by allowing her to remain in charge of the interrogation. Her hands would be tied, but it would still be less humiliating than being removed from the role entirely. I don't like this, she said. But you'll do it anyway, Bettany finished for her. That's how it has to be, Mez. If we're wrong, if this gets us nowhere, then I'll be the first to admit my error. But until that point, we're doing it my way. Mazarian scowled. She turned around and stalked back to the waiting weapon, snatching it from the air as if grabbing a wasp. She adjusted the dial again, then looked back at us, her fingers white around the pistol's grip. Have it your way, boys and girls.